Legs McNeil, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
Monday, September 5th. Tune in all sorts of creative community voices on the air at 90.7 FM WGXC, including at 9 a.m. on the WGXC Morning Show. Tune in Absolute Value of Noise and Anna Fritz, two artists recently working at Wave Farm and installing a new installation called Solar Radio that you can listen to at wgxc.org/listen. At 10 a.m., it's time for the Afrosonic Taxi to take off this week with tracks from So George, Macy Gray, and La Gabaja, among others. At noon, after the local news on the Deep 3 show, hear works from Kristen Nordeval, Armin Jawadi, and Bobby Previtt, among others. Scanner Julia Reedy and Andre Rikishi have new music at 2 p.m. on the Vital Weekly show. And then at 8 p.m., tune in a brand new show on WGXC from Winslow from Athens. The show is called Upon the Cypress Bough, and a showcase for music from Western Asia, North Africa, and Central Asia. That's from 8 to 10 p.m., debuting for the first time Monday, September 5th on 90.7 FM WGXC. Turn out for a special performance from Leah Bertucci, Sunday, September 18th at Opus 40 in Saugerties. Bertucci is performing on Electronics Voice Samples and Multi-Channel Radio, using four low-range FM transmitters provided from Wave Farm and used to send audio throughout the performance to radios installed within the labyrinth walls of Opus 40 to create a spatialized sonic gesture. Audience members are urged to circulate among the Opus 40 grounds to hear, to make their own live mix of the performance. Bertucci is working with Ben Vita, Zach Layton, and Victoria Ketty on the project. It's Sunday, September 18th, from 4:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. at Opus 40 in Saugerties. Find out more on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at wgxc.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you will do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org/donate now.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Tunstall Studio Publishing of Craryville, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You are tuned to 90.7 FM. WGXC. Grabbable, handleable, listener-fueled radio for Greene and Columbia counties.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Mid-Hudson News reports that Governor Kathy Hochul was in Ulster County September 1st. For an update on the wildfires that have burned at least 270 acres since starting last week. She said the fires may burn themselves out and blamed them on climate change.
The DEC predicts that ultimately it will burn itself out. It may take a week, it may take 2 weeks, but we don't expect it to be able to threaten any life or structure. We have to expect the unexpected because the unexpected has now become the norm. That is our reality. That is our reality. And anyone who denies that, just come to New York. Let me show you how our state has changed so dramatically. Ask the farmers how different it is for them with their crops. Ask anyone in the tourism industry, places up on Lake Ontario, that had a 100-year flood in 2017 and another 100-year flood in 2019. I made the observation, doesn't someone owe us 98 years in between these? So the 500-year event we had in New York City, the 100-year events we're seeing upstate, with flooding in our Great Lakes all the way to our rivers and valleys here in the Catskills. This is the world we're dealing with. It's harsh.
Read the full story at Mid-Hudson News. Andrea Mako reports for Porcupine Soup that Columbia Memorial Health employees again made a point about the hospital's staff shortages with a protest in Hudson on September 1st. Hudson Mayor Kamal Johnson and State Senator Michelle Henchy joined hospital union employees asking for hiring more staff. Kim Gibson, a union organizer with 1199 SEIU United Healthcare Workers East, said, and I quote, "It is not unusual to hear the term staffing shortages in today's healthcare world. What is unusual here in Hudson at our local hospital is that the units and clinics have had to close for a day or days due to no staff," end quote. She said that currently there are 328 open positions at the hospital and its off-sites. She said, and I quote, "That's a large portion of the workforce," end quote. Last month, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand wrote a letter to the hospital with a similar message. Gillibrand wrote, and I quote, "Due to low wages and high turnover, CMH is operating at a staff vacancy of more than 200 bargaining unit members. This extreme understaffing has caused the closure of beds and clinics, decreasing the availability of the already limited health care services in the area," end quote. CMH President and CEO J.P. Callahan agreed that, and I quote, "there is a shortage of health care workers," end quote, but said the hospital is not to blame. Callahan said, and I quote, "the union will attempt to identify this shortage as a local issue, but we know and can demonstrate that it is a national issue and one that is especially acute in upstate New York hospitals," end quote. Read the full story at Porcupine Soup. Rick Collin reports in the Times Union that hunting groups are criticizing Representative Elise Stefanik for a bill she's co-sponsoring that would repeal a decades-old excise tax on firearms. The gun tax funds wildlife conservation and other environmental protections. Caden MacArthur, the government relations representative for Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, said, and I quote, "there wasn't any consultation with sportsmen's or sportswomen's groups," end quote. The bill is more political theater than reality right now, as Democratic majorities in Congress are unlikely to pass the measure. Shortly after Democratic Representative Don Byers of Virginia introduced a bill to impose a 1,000% excise tax on assault-style weapons earlier this year, Republicans introduced the Repealing Excise Tax on Unalienable Rights Now Act. Stefanik said, and I quote, "I am proud to join my colleagues in introducing legislation to eliminate this harmful tax that infringes on Americans' ability to exercise their Second Amendment rights. Make no mistake, I will not allow the government to tax the constitutional right of hardworking Americans by marking up the price to exercise one's Second Amendment rights," end quote. The tax dates back to 1937 and generates $18 million annually for New York State and more than $400 million since 1939 for a range of wildlife habitat protection and restoration efforts, as well as hunter safety programs. The Howl for Wildlife Group, the National Wildlife Federation, the National Wild Turkey Federation, and the Sportsmen's Alliance are among the groups in opposition to Stefanik on the issue. Stefanik represents the 21st Congressional District that will include Rensselaer County beginning next year. Read the full story in the Times Union. And that wraps up the WGXE News Update. You can visit our website for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXE sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXE Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
The confluence of race, class, and climate in Jackson, Mississippi's water crisis. Jackson, the state capital of Mississippi, has a population of over 150,000 people, more than 80% of whom are African American. Mississippi is the poorest state in the country. Jackson residents, already under a water boil notice for over a month, have now had no running water for days to drink, to bathe in, or to flush toilets. The Pearl River flooded following record rainfall, overwhelming the city's water treatment plant. On Sunday, Mayor Chokwe Antar Lumumba urged city residents,
"If you are capable of getting out now, get out now. Get out as soon as possible."
Jackson has been paralyzed by the confluence of racism, classism, and the worsening climate catastrophe. On Tuesday, President Joe Biden declared an emergency for Jackson and surrounding Hinds County, promising federal funding to pay the bulk of disaster recovery costs for at least 90 days. A rented pump was put into service at the water facility on Wednesday and may help restore water service within a week. But that's only a temporary fix. Jackson's water problems run far deeper.
We are seeing the intentional divestment in communities that are led by black elected officials.
That's Jackson resident and social justice organizer Danielle Holmes talking to Reuters at a water distribution center this week.
This has been an issue for me since I came down here to Tougaloo College in 1991. I was always told not to drink that water. When I came here to Jackson, it was smelling like chlorine.
The climate-fueled polar vortex that descended on Texas in February of 2021, shutting down that state's electrical grid and subjecting millions of Texans to devastating cold, killing an estimated 700 people, also hit other southern states. Jackson's water treatment plant froze then, shutting off residents' access to water. Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves and Lieutenant Governor Delbert Hoseman, both white Republicans, blamed Jackson for that crisis. Governor Reeves told the press last year, "I do think it's really important that the city of Jackson start collecting their water bill payments before they start going and asking everyone else to pony up more money," he said. This is Jackson was in its third week without water.
The city of Jackson was not ill-prepared based on the winter storms. We were ill-equipped.
That's Mayor Chokwe Antar Lumumba responding back then, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
We've had resources stripped away from us.
Jackson was founded 200 years ago, named in honor of Andrew Jackson, a wealthy plantation owner who made a fortune using enslaved labor and who later, as the seventh president of the United States, orchestrated the ethnic cleansing of much of the South's indigenous population in what became known as the Trail of Tears. Union General William Tecumseh Sherman ordered the city burned to the ground during the Civil War. Later, the city of Jackson suffered some of the worst racial violence as Jim Crow laws disenfranchised African Americans across the South, and white supremacist terrorism waged by the Ku Klux Klan and others drove millions of blacks north in the Great Migration. In 1963, Medgar Evers, the NAACP's Mississippi field secretary, was assassinated outside his Jackson home. This followed the violence and arrest targeting hundreds of freedom riders who arrived in Jackson in the summer of 1961, challenging segregation of interstate travel. In 1964, three civil rights workers, James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner, were murdered in nearby Neshoba County for helping the black community organize voter registration. Their bodies were buried in a dam being built on a farm to impound water that would have flowed into the Pearl River upstream from Jackson. On May 15, 1970, two students at Jackson State, the historically black college, were killed by local police during an anti-war protest. Their deaths received little attention compared to the four white protesters killed by the National Guard at Kent State University in Ohio 11 days earlier.
What we are experiencing now is literally just the crumbling of the empire's infrastructure. I think everybody needs to be clear about that.
That's Kali Okuno, co-founder of Cooperation Jackson, which promotes worker-owned co-ops and a solidarity economy, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
It goes back to I would argue, to the 1950s and 60s with the so-called urban renewal programs and the massive subsidization of the suburbs, which facilitated white flight out of many of these major cities, Jackson being one of them, and with that went major capital flight. And that has continued with very chronic programs of divestment and deindustrialization.
Caliacuno heeded Mayor Lumumba's warning to flee the flooding this week and was in New Orleans remotely coordinating Cooperation Jackson's water distribution efforts. Repairing Jackson's infrastructure will take an estimated $2 billion. That's a tiny fraction of the public funds allocated by the recently enacted infrastructure and climate change bills. The resources exist to solve Jackson's current catastrophe. It'll take solidarity on a national level to overcome the triple ongoing impacts assaulting the citizens of Jackson, Mississippi: racism, classism, and the spiraling disaster of climate change. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC News Update. Go to the WGXC Newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Brian Hubert reports for the Daily Freeman that as of September 3rd, the Napanock Point wildfire was 75% contained, and firefighters expect to have it fully contained by the end of the Labor Day weekend, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation said. DEC spokesperson Larry Severino said the fire remained active as of September 3rd, but officials lowered the estimate of acreage burned from 163 acres to 142 acres. Ulster County officials said the estimate of the area burned decreased because they received more accurate data. The latest reports had 75% of the fire under a manageable condition where it cannot spread further, Severino said. The department said no homes or businesses have been affected by the fire. Severino said 129 people were working on the fire Saturday, down from nearly 200 the previous day. She said the mutual aid continues from firefighters and departments in Dutchess County and as far away as Quebec in Canada. Quote, bulldozers and hand crews from multiple agencies will continue to build indirect and direct control lines, unquote, a post on Ulster County's Instagram page said on September 4th. The post also said that state police helicopters will continue bucket drops to cool hot spots. The Napanock Point fire is believed to have started on August 2nd because of a lightning strike. The rain overnight on August 30th helped to slow the fire spread and allowed firefighters to construct control lines. Another wildfire at Minnewaska State Park, the Stony Kill Fire, was contained as of September 2nd, Ulster County Executive Pat Ryan said in a Facebook post. The Wurtsboro Fire in Sullivan County is now 100% contained with 75 acres burned there, Severino said. The Minnewaska Preserve remains closed at least through Labor Day weekend. Read more about the story in the Daily Freeman. The Village of Athens last week joined other municipalities in the Hudson Valley and imposed restrictions on water usage as a result of the ongoing regional drought. Village officials September 2nd notified residents that the lack of rainfall has resulted in seriously low water levels at the village reservoir. The water warning was immediately went into effect. Mayor Amy Sirago has imposed mandatory limits on water use for a variety of purposes, including watering lawns, washing cars, pressure washing, and any other non-essential use. Those restrictions will remain in place until further notice. Under the rules, residents are strongly discouraged from planting new sod and are strongly encouraged to postpone planting of all new shrubs, flowers, trees, gardens, and other landscaping until conditions subside. Water runoff is strictly prohibited. Residents are advised to eliminate the use of water to maintain ornamental fountains, artificial waterfalls, reflection pools, and decorative water bodies for aesthetic or scenic purposes. And filling swimming pools, wading pools, or hot tubs is forbidden. Officials put conditions at stage two, calling for increased public awareness and the enforcement of mandatory measures such as watering restrictions. At the water warning stage, the village is expected to reduce the collective water demand by 30%. Read more at athensvillageny.com. Ted Remsnyder reports for Columbia Green Media that Bread Folks Bakery, an establishment that offered gourmet breads and pastries in Hudson, has closed its doors for good after 2 years of operation, according to an August 29th social media post from company owner Norma Jean Roy. Roy said the business, located in the 300 block of Warren Street, had run its course despite its success. Quote, in the 2 years we've been open, we've served over 200,000 customers and made over 400,000 breads and pastries on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. While this may seem small by some bigger bakery standards, that's a lot for our small bakery staff in our small town of Hudson. We shattered our wildest expectations, garnered industry and media accolades, and secured a legion of fans, all in pursuit of excellence. Seeing our relentless lines start 30 minutes before opening every day always left us in awe and made us grateful, unquote. A fashion photographer by profession, Roy said Bread Folks had reached its business milestones sooner than anticipated, and that he decided to close the bakery's retail location and, quote, focus all our energy on Bread Folks' next chapter, unquote. Lori Dardenny, owner of Steiner Sports, located across the street from the bakery, said she has seen the Hudson business community constantly change over the last five decades since her family purchased the bike and ski shop in 1971. Quote, I'm not concerned, unquote, Dardenny said. Quote, I think it was just their choice, unquote. Jonathan Simmons, the owner of Jonathan's Computers, another bakery neighbor, said he would classify the Warren Street business scene as healthy. Quote, if you are in Hudson on the weekends, then you see the large number of people that are out shopping and dining, unquote, he said. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com and read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom, WGXC.org. I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC Renewable Weather Report. And we start each renewable weather report with the price of fossil fuels in Greene County. $3.91 is the lowest price for a gallon of gas in Greene County right now, according to the Gas Buddy website. That's at the Citgo in South Cairo. Then we look at the air quality forecast, and it's a 30, which is still in the good range for Sunday. And we've been watching closely as those wildfires in Ulster County continue, and the air quality has not seemed to have risen measurably by those fires. The UV index is a 6 forecast on Sunday. That's in the high range, so you should wear a wide-brimmed hat, sunglasses, and SPF 30 plus sunscreen if you're out in the sun for too long on Sunday. National Weather Service in Albany predicts there is a 40% chance of isolated showers and possibly a thunderstorm after noon on Sunday. Should be mostly cloudy with a high of 80 and a low around 60. 50% chance of rain overnight Sunday. Labor Day Monday, showers are likely. There's an 80% chance. Possibly a thunderstorm after 11 a.m. with a high of 68 and a low around 60. Tuesday, again, there's a chance of showers. This time only 40%. With cloudy skies, a high near 69 and a low around 58. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, solar-powered radio for open ears.
It is time once again to check in with a community organization that is making our world a better place, and we're joined now by Bobby Wilding, Executive Director and Co-Founder of Clean and Healthy New York. Bobby, welcome back to Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I have to say, you interviewed with us just last year when you became executive director.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, it's been a really amazing and busy year and a half, and I'm really excited with everything we've been doing, not only for that, but also our entire 16-year history.
So you've got so much important work going on right now. I think we should get right to it. And if listeners want to learn more about your history and your mission, they can visit your website, which we'll share. So what's your latest?
So we've been having a busy summer. We are working with the Arbor Hill Development Corporation and the mapping company Vertices to put together information about the environmental harms that are being faced by residents of the Arbor Hill and other surrounding neighborhoods in Albany. And the effort is going to result in maps that people in the community can actually add to and contribute to over time, so we can really build up a plan for how residents want to take control of what's going on in their community and get problems that they're facing fixed.
Crowdsourcing, the benefits of crowdsourcing.
That's right. And then we're going to be building on that, and with support from a grant from the New York State Pollution Prevention Institute, we're going to be holding a series of meetings with Albany residents and leaders, pulling from the data that we're collecting, but also just sort of looking around at some of the other changes that are coming, the conversation that's happening about taking down 787 to grant greater access to the Hudson River, some of the expansion that's going on in the Port of Albany, to really try to understand how community members are thinking about this and how we can support community problem solving.
And community members, I'm assuming, can get right involved via your website. Is that right?
We'll have that information up when the project launches. We're expecting that to start in October, so that we're building for it now.
Excellent. Can you tell us about your legislative agenda? I understand that the governor is running out of time to sign some legislation that you prefer. What are your priority bills?
So Clean and Healthy New York works on building a just and healthy world where toxic chemicals are simply unthinkable. And there were a number of bills that passed this session that we think are important for the governor to sign. One of them was introduced by Assemblywoman Fahey here in Albany, her bill to ban the class of nonstick chemicals called PFAS in our clothing to make sure that, you know, we have clothes that are free of that. That would make sure that we're not exposed when we're wearing the clothes, and also that we're not flushing PFAS down the drain into our drinking water when we do our laundry. Another bill that we're very excited about action on is a bill to address cumulative impacts. Right now, when a company applies to create a new facility, oftentimes the regulations just require looking at what that will do to the community on its own, as if it were the only thing happening. And most often we know that facilities get sited in communities of color and low-income communities, and that they're already experiencing a whole range of environmental harms. And so actually taking into account for cumulative impacts will help prevent continuing to overburden communities that have already been put upon far too much.
I just have to opine on this or comment that I'm thinking of the Dunn dump. So cumulative in two senses. Cumulative in the sense of many polluters all together,
yes.
But also over time, I think, is one of the issues as well. Is that right?
It would look at sort of what are the conditions in the community, so that we actually have to make sure that we're considering all of those impacts and not adding on top to exacerbate risks for cancer, other health problems that we know come from being in contact, breathing in, drinking, having, skin contact with toxic chemicals. And one of the other bills that passed both houses last year would actually address a whole slew of known cancer-causing chemicals. It's called the Clearing the Toxic Air Bill, and it would ban things like benzene and vinyl chloride and mercury from the air. It would require the DEC to actually have standards for them, which they don't right now. And it's, I think it's one of the things that is always alarming to me, is that we think about, the 1970s, major laws passed that are supposed to protect our health, and to find that there are really obvious glaring absences that we still have to come back and correct. And so I think those are a couple of the bills that will help to address that problem. And then there's another one that I think doesn't necessarily seem like it might be in keeping with what we focus on, but there's a Digital Fair Repair Act that, again, is Assemblywoman Fahey's, and it would make it easier for us to repair our electronic devices. Given all of the different toxic chemicals that go into making electronic devices, it's critical that we use them for as long as possible. And frankly, it's also just a cost-saving measure. If we could all fix our phones when the battery died, think about how many fewer cell phones we would need to have out there. Think about how many laptops we could be saving if we could actually get in there and repair them.
That makes all the sense in the world. Let me ask you this just as a matter of process. How does it work in New York? Now that these bills have passed both houses, if she does nothing, do they become law? Or do they require her signature and you hope for her signature because she should put her affirmative stamp of approval on these things?
So she does need to sign them. She can do it quietly or she can do it loudly, but she does need to sign them. And she has until the end of the year to do it.
The end of the year. Okay.
So she's got some time, but